Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined by Dr. J. Peter Pham, one of our duty experts on Africa. He holds a position as director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, the author of numerous books, including one he co-authored with Greg Mills and David Kilcullen entitled Somalia, Fixing Africa's Most Failed State. Welcome back, Peter. It's good to have you with us.
Frank, always a pleasure to talk to you.
Let's talk about Boko Haram first, Peter. This is, of course, an al-Qaeda franchise that has now sworn its loyalty to the Islamic State, declared itself to be part of a caliphate. You have been raising concerns about the increasing sophistication of its military operations against the Nigerian military. What's going on there, and what are the implications?
Well, a couple of things, Frank. First, beginning probably in end of January, Nigeria and its neighbors began pushing back on Boko Haram. Remember, back in January, Boko Haram had managed to seize territory, probably depending on which analysts you speak to, either the size of Maryland or something larger, and had occupied it and set up their little emirate, if you will, with a headquarters in Gwoza, a town of about 150,000 people, so not insignificant. But then the military forces began rolling back the territory and taking back territory, at which point Boko Haram, which had had ties to al-Qaeda, hadn't formally become an affiliate, turned and swore its allegiance to the Islamic State. Now, we've talked in the past about how last year the two groups, the so-called Islamic State and Boko Haram, had been romancing each other and doing shout-outs and perhaps a little bit of backroom support in terms of technical capabilities of videos and things like that. And they swore allegiance, and within very short order, that allegiance was accepted. At that time, a lot of analysts thought this is a group that's on its, in desperate straits because of the military push against it, so it needs a fill-up. And at that time, the Islamic State was also getting pushback, so it needed sort of a morale boost, and the allegiance provided it. Since then, Boko Haram has metastasized. This is a group with a great deal of resilience. It's increased its terrorist attacks. In fact, this past week launched its first attack against Chad's capital, N'Djamena, attack on two police facilities, which left over two dozen people killed, two attacks. Just in recent days, it's launched attacks against targets in Niger. So it's carrying out terrorist attacks in neighboring countries. And in fact, just today, launched attacks on a market in Maiduguri, the capital of Borno State, Nigeria. But it's not just the terrorist attacks, but it's also been the military tactics. Something happened after the rebranding of Boko Haram as the Islamic State's West Africa province, as it's calling itself nowadays. And that's been the sophistication of its attacks on military forces. It's no longer just hit and run or attacks followed by the military fleeing, but relatively sophisticated ambushes and other things. So clearly there's a qualitative shift, and that's very dangerous.
And Peter Pham, before we switch gears to Sudan, just in closing, do you regard what's developing on the ground, not just now in Nigeria, but in Chad and Niger, as evidence that Boko Haram is becoming, unfortunately, a still more formidable threat to the region and perhaps beyond?
Well, I'm not sure I'm ready to say more formidable, but I'm certainly going to say that it remains a major threat to the region, and reports of its demise that were trumpeted by not only some in the Nigerian government, especially the outgoing administration, but also by people on this side of the Atlantic who tried to downplay the group's significance. Those reports are, as Mark Twain once said, rather exaggerated.
We're talking with Dr. Peter Pham, director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council. He's also a member of the Senior Advisory Group of U.S. Africa Command and has been since its inception. Peter, let me, as I say, ask you to turn your gaze to another part of the African continent, Sudan. Now, two countries. It's been broken into. The original piece of Sudan, the north, largely under the brutally repressive Islamists control, the southern part, now a separate nation but riven by civil war. Maybe we could start with the latter. What is the latest on developments there, Peter, and a real humanitarian crisis that seems to be developing as a result of the war?
A couple things are going on. Right now, South Sudan is in the middle of the rainy season, and so that limits the ability to carry out major military operations because what few roads there are in the country are largely not paved, and the rainy season turns most of the country into a literal bog. And so as a result of that, military actions have been relatively limited, and there have been on and off, in fact, this week on again, discussions of peace. But this is a lull in the fighting dictated by the weather more than any real peace. And in the meantime, however, the rains, the impassibility of land has exacerbated the food security situation. Hundreds of thousands of people are cut off from food aid because they simply can't get through. In the meantime, farmers aren't planting those that aren't displaced. You know, several million people have already been displaced. But those who aren't displaced aren't planting because if you're insecure, uncertain about whether you're going to be around next week, much less when harvest time comes, you're not going to plant. You might as well take your seed and eat it. At least that way you nourish you and your family, which is setting the country up for a major food crisis when the harvest is due and nothing's been planted.
And this is all the more amazing, of course, because this is a country endowed with enormous petroleum resources, and to the prospect that it would starve to death is just beyond belief.
Most of the unfortunately, the oil production has been cut by more than two-thirds, so the money isn't coming in. Partially because of the fighting, partially because the engineers they need to run those things have fled, understandably.
Peter, a crisis of the first order. Let me turn to the country to its north, Sudan. You had a spectacle recently of the Islamist who has been running the place for years, General Bashir, in South Africa and wanted by the International Criminal Court but allowed to escape. Give us a sense of what happened in all of that.
President Bashir went to South Africa, which was hosting this year the annual meeting of the heads of state and government of the African Union. Now, the African Union, a while back, came out with a statement saying that its members shouldn't cooperate with the International Criminal Court because the International Criminal Court was biased against Africans. The South African government decided that it would honor the AU's declaration. So a NGO brought a lawsuit before a high court judge to compel the arrest of Bashir on this warrant. While the court was considering the motions and had ordered that the Sudanese leader not leave the country, with the obvious collusion of the South African government, his plane, which was parked at a civilian commercial airport, was moved to a military airstrip, and then he got on board and flew back to Khartoum to a triumphal return. But the underlying issue is not so much the alleged war crimes perpetrated by Bashir in the Darfur conflict, but the fact that the International Criminal Court has been attempting to operate in a vacuum. You know, justice only works when there's political legitimacy for the process. And it's not saying that the ICC or the charges being brought against various African leaders aren't without foundation. But the ICC has not been very good at cultivating that political legitimacy. It's allowed cynical leaders to, as well as those who act in good faith, to say that the ICC has some sort of bias against Africans. They use that to justify their non-cooperation with it.
It is a deeply problematic institution, it seems to me, Peter, and you've just touched on some of the examples of why. We have to let it go at that, though, my friend. Thank you so much for joining us. As always, come back to us soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.